friends, and welcome back to yet another episode of What Page Are You On? It me, Bethany Rutter, and I'm here with my good friend and business partner.
It me, Alice Slater.
How are you today, Alice Slater?
I'm really gorge, thank you. How are you today?
I am also gorge. I have no complaints, you know, nothing to complain about.
First of December, yes. First day of Advent.
Have not opened my Advent calendar yet, but I will, because I love a treat.
What's your Advent calendar?
It is, my mommy gave it to me. It's like chocolate of Marks and Spencer's, so little, you know, walnut whips and little, you know, like little Ooh. Things like that. Yes, very fun. I love a walnut whip. How about you? Do you have one?
I have two, because I'm spoiled. my mom gave me a L'Occitane one, which is quite exciting. And then I have a Thornton's one.
Delicious.
So I'm jazzed. And I think today we're gonna make some mulled wine. We're gonna tidy up in preparation for the Christmas tree, which we'll probably get the weekend.
Classic tidying.
And just feeling cozy.
I love this.
Just
for us.
Leaning in.
Well, it's very apt that we're having a cozy day because we are. I feel like this is a cozy topic that we're gonna do today.
I think so. It's certainly cozy, about as cozy as we get.
Yes. So today, my friends, we wanted to talk about the grande dame of mystery writing, Agatha Christie.
Whee!
Part of the reason that we decided to do an episode on Agatha Christie is that my good friend and business partner, Alice Slater, had not read any. Is that true?
Never.
That's true.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, not quite true. I did start reading The Halloween Party, one Halloween, and was like, this
not
blows. Like
Yeah, I've not actually heard of that. I don't know that one.
Yeah, not one of the more famous ones, I don't think.
Yes. And obviously she does have a lot, you know, so it's not all going to slap.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to kick things off by sharing some Agatha Christie facts, if I may.
Yes, you may.
So what inspired this episode was partly that I have not really read much, whereas you were quite the fan.
Yes.
But also that, you know, we've been working through blockbusters. So we've done The Da Vinci Code, we've done Twilight. So Agatha Christie felt like another, you know, book to check off that list. Agatha Christie was another book, you know what I'm saying. So she was born in 1890. She's written in her lifetime, she passed away in the 1970s. In her lifetime, she wrote 66 novels in total, plus 14 short story collections, plus several plays, which
a mad
is just...
bitch.
A mind-blowing body of work. Her play, The Mousetrap, is the world's longest-running play.
Seen it.
It was going... Seen it too. Loved it. Did you like it?
Yeah, fun.
Yeah, I thought it was really fun. A tight little banger. Highly recommend it. So it was performed in the West End, first in 1952, and then continuously until 2020, when obviously the West End shut down, and they had to stop the performance. It has continued, though, so technically it is still going.
Yeah, yeah, I've seen it since the Rona, so I can confirm it is still going.
She holds the Guinness World Record as the best-selling fiction writer of all time.
Good for her.
Her novels having sold, this is a mind-blowing number, more than 2 billion copies worldwide.
That's absolutely wild.
That's like, what's the population of the planet? Isn't it like 7 billion?
Yeah, something like that.
So like that's 2 Agatha Christie books for every 7 people that walk this earth.
Yeah, and I assume, you know, they're all here now. This isn't over the last, you know, 100 years. It's just all simultaneously.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
And she's also the most translated author in the world. Her works have been translated into 103 languages. And with a total of 7,236 translations.
That is so wild. That is just so much.
Isn't that wild? And then I have a final fact for us. And Then There Were None, which is the first book we're going to discuss, is one of the top-selling books of all time, having sold approximately 100 million copies.
That is
100
so
million!
Yeah.
100 million copies. That blows my mind. Richard Osman could
probably will, yeah.
If he writes 100 books and they continue to sell at the rate they're selling right now,
yeah,
he's on his way.
He is on track.
So those are my Agatha Christie facts. There was also a fun anecdote which I just couldn't be bothered to research properly, but that she herself went missing. Have you ever heard this?
Yes, I have. Partly because it is a lot in... What was that book that we read that was set at UEA?
Oh, yes. The...
Truants?
Truants, yeah.
Yes, I feel like it comes up a lot in that, doesn't it? That's a kind of key... Because it's an Agatha Christie researcher. You know, the lecturer is an expert in Agatha Christie.
Yeah.
And so her disappearance comes up quite a lot in the book. So that was where I first became familiar with it. But please, tell us again. Tell for the room.
So basically, I'm going to do this very briefly. In a nutshell, she went missing for 11 days or so after her husband told her that he was leaving her for another woman. No one knew where she was. It was a national scandal. It was in all the papers. They had helicopters and search teams looking for her. She eventually turned up in a hotel under her husband's paramour's surname. And to this day, no one really knows exactly what happened. There were lots of different theories. Some people thought she did it on purpose to embarrass him. Some people thought she was trying to frame him for her murder. Some people thought that she'd had a breakdown. The only thing that we know is that she was reported as seeming quite confused when she was found. Isn't that wild?
It is wild. I would say it's most likely she had a breakdown.
Yeah, I mean...
TBQH.
Also, this was in the 1960s, so I feel like people's grasp of, like, the ways in which people can behave during emotional stress and, like, mental illness was quite limited compared to now. So actually,
also, I just feel like if you've been married to someone for more than 30 years and they're like, I'm off, you would probably have a meltdown, you know?
Yeah, that's going to affect your faculties.
Indeed.
But there is, I think a book has come out from Picador, I believe, this year, that focuses on that story, which might interest you.
Yeah, that rings a bell. I'll look into it.
Something to think about.
Yes, much to consider.
Anyway, so that's my Agatha Christie fact sheet for you. Let's dive into And Then There Were None.
Yes. So, I really like this one. You're not as much of a fan.
I struggled with it, but I can articulate exactly why I struggled with it.
Talk to me, my friend. Oh, no, wait. Maybe we should not show the plot.
Oh,
also,
yeah, okay.
I just feel like it, because the plot and obviously mystery and resolution of a mystery is so important to these books, I think it's not really worth us talking about them unless we can talk about the resolution. So I'm going to say that we should do spoilers in this ep.
Okay, yeah. Same deal as Da Vinci and Twilight.
Yeah.
So if up to this point you're like, I'm intrigued, I would like to listen to this further, but I don't want the plot spoiled, stop the episode, read And Then There Were None and Murder on the Orient Express, and then come back.
We will still be here.
We will be here waiting for you.
So the plot of Then There Were None are like 10 different people from different walks of life and different places are summoned to an island off the coast of south coast of England, and all kind of believing that they're going there for some purpose that's related to their life, like whether that's employment or meeting up with an old friend or something. And when they arrive, it turns out that that is not the case. They've all been summoned here by some mysterious person. And then one by one, they start turning up dead. So that's basically the plot of And Then There Were None.
Very classic, but never had been done before.
Yes.
Right? Like, this was the first whodunit in which it was, like, a locked door, isolated, like, situation.
I assume so. I mean, I feel like, you know, everything that we know now in thrillers, Agatha Christie did first, but I am completely willing to be corrected that there may have been, like, someone else doing these things before her that I do not know about.
Well, certainly if there was, she wasn't aware of them, because she talks about in her author's note that the biggest struggle was coming up with a way in which 10 people could die without becoming obvious who the murder was.
Interesting.
Which kind of implies to me it was a fresh puzzle that she was unpicking.
Yeah.
But definitely prepared to stand corrected. I didn't really research her writing process with this book. The thing I didn't like about it, there were two things I didn't like about it. Although I did end up enjoying it, so I don't feel like, I hope this doesn't put anyone off reading it. First of all, I found it really difficult to keep track of 10 characters, because they are all introduced in the first chapter. Each character gets a kind of mini chapter, like a kind of page and a half, two page, three page little intro, which starts with their name and their journey to the island and basically like what's going on in their lives, written in a very close third person. So it kind of gives you the setup and gives you a quick fire intro to everyone, but it was too many characters in one go. I immediately was just like, I can't keep track of this. I'm just going to have to vibe. I would have loved to have had a cheat sheet at the front to remind me of each character's name and their like occupation and where they're from. Because you can't look up that information without getting a spoiler. And I feel like if you've gone through this far in life without having And Then There Were None spoiled, what a shame to get it spoiled because you can't remember who Mr. De Whimsyton is, you know?
Yes.
The second thing I didn't like about it very much is that I did find the writing style of those first 10 mini chapters really twee.
Mm.
You know, like there were a lot of exclamation marks going on. There's a lot of like, what a fine day to be a man. Like, I just kind of found it really jarring. And it's not really the kind of like line level writing that I'm normally kind of interested in.
Yes. I see how that can be true.
And then I also, but I will go into this further, I was quite shocked by the anti-Semitism of Captain Lombard.
Yes, and that is quite early on in the book, and so that is quite a striking feature of the beginning of And Then There Were None.
So, to go back over my three beeves, what do you think of the 10 characters? Do you think it matters that I struggled to keep track of them?
I just think it's one of those books where, to a certain degree, it just doesn't really matter who is who. Like, I don't know, I feel like with Agatha Christie books, and maybe that's because I have like read enough and I am familiar vaguely enough with like how they operate or what to expect, that like if I'm struggling to differentiate who people are, I'm like, that's because it doesn't really matter. For some plot reason, it doesn't really matter that I can't remember like what this person is doing or like why they're there. I think within Then There Were None, I think I just am like, there's 10 people, they're getting murdered one by one. Let's just see how this plays out. Like, you know, I don't know. Either it's one of them or it's not. Either it's, you know, it's just sort of, these are just like bodies that need to be present for some reason. And then, yeah, I don't know.
Agreed.
The writing.
What about the writing style?
Yeah, I think because it's from like the point of view of those characters, I think that's probably more true of that bit of the book, whereas I don't feel like necessarily the writing in general is like that. Do you know what I mean? Like, because it's from the, like, it's almost like the voice of those characters, whereas in general I think she has quite, not like a dry style, but quite like a neutral tone. Like, it isn't that kind of, you know, I don't know.
She writes in a very functional manner, which is what a lot of commercial books have in common.
Yes.
Like, even though there are some lines that I kind of underlined for being like really kind of pleasing, I guess. Beautiful's the wrong word, but like
enjoyable in some way.
Yeah, like there's a line when they're eating dinner after the first murder. And I just loved this line. Discussion of the island was, by mutual consent, tabooed.
Hmm.
You know, it's like very, very neat, but very elegant.
Yeah, yeah. Elegante.
I liked it. And then, yeah, finally, the anti-Semitism of Captain Lombard. And also, he's very racist as well.
Yes. So, at first, obviously, and, you know, this plays into the fact that it comes right at the beginning when you're being introduced to loads of characters. I think at first it is quite easy to be like, oh, like, this is like, you know, a product of its time, and this is from the point of view of someone who, you know, the author is expressing, you know, anti-Semitic views. And maybe she did also hold anti-Semitic views, but I feel like the further you get into the book and the more you hear from that specific character, the more obvious it is that it is him expressing racist views that are contextualized by the people around him, I think.
Yes, yeah, definitely. Because I didn't actually make, because of being quite confused by the characters, I didn't make that connection. And I was talking to my husband, and I read out the first kind of anti-Semitic moment, and then later on, a racist moment. And my husband was like, oh, but that's the same character. And I was like, what? He's like, look, it's the same character both times. And I was like, oh shit, am I trying to cancel Agatha Christie? Like, she's fucking Jonathan Franzen, like, for filling her books with horrible things. And so I think that's one of the reasons why struggling to keep track of the characters was kind of, there's a bit of a downside, because I did kind of miss that. And just thought, like, how is this still in print?
You know? Interestingly, the book that we are referring to as And Then There Were None was not always called that.
Oh, shit. Yes.
So it's had not one but two quite racist names. First published as 10 Little N-Words. And then republished in a, you know, less racist name, 10 Little Indians. But, you know, still quite racist connotations.
And that both of those are from, the whole framework of the book is based around a nursery rhyme, which is 10 little soldier boys went out to dine. It's kind of like 10 little bottles, or kind of like that Edward Gorey poem about how children die. It's like, yes, 10 people, 10 little soldier boys and how they die. And it ends with, and then there were none.
So what I would like to know, and have not really been able to establish, because I was listening to an audiobook, you know, recorded in the 21st century by lovely Dan Stevens, and do not have a copy of, like, the original book from the 1939. In the book, you know, like, it's the soldier boys. Was it, like, the N-word in
the original book? It must have been.
Yeah, I would guess so. Because I'm like, yeah, why was it never renamed as, like, 10 Little Soldiers? Wild.
Although, I mean, obviously we could speculate without knowing for sure, they may have used a different term.
Yes.
You know, like, I don't know. I don't know, but it's fucking uncomfortable. Do you, yes, know what I mean? Also, because the island is called Soldier Island.
Yeah, and I assume it was never called N-Word Island.
I would fucking hope not.
I mean, why would any island off the coast of England be called that? Like, literally, well, why? Like, yeah. Who knows?
Yeah, we know why.
We know why.
Our vile history. But yeah, I find that completely wild. Do you know what year it was renamed?
Like the 80s?
Fucking 60s. Hell. Okay.
So hang on, let me have a look. A US edition was released. Okay, so in the UK came out 1939, 10 Little N-Words. A US edition was released in January 1940 with the title And Then There Were None. So, as early as 1940, 1 year after the English publication, Americans were already calling it And Then There Were None.
Interesting.
All successive American reprints and adaptations use that title, except for the Pocket Books paperbacks published between 1964 and 1986, which appeared under the title 10 Little Indians. UK editions continued to use the original title until the current definitive title appeared with a reprint of the 1963 Fontana paperback in 1985. I don't know what that last bit means, but whatever. So, yeah, I want going on there.
So it was called 10 Little N-Words until the year of my brother's birth.
Yes.
That's fucking wild, isn't it?
Yes.
Especially when there is another title that is, yeah, has absolutely no controversy to it whatsoever. Yeah. Although I suppose I say that, but then the nursery rhyme, it does have it's credited to Frank Green, 1869.
It is a minstrel song. Which,
I see. I see. So it's not like purely uncontroversial, because it's, yes, the source material is still that.
So now we know.
Interesting.
Okay, so we've covered two of your beefs. What was the third beef?
No, that was it. We've covered all three. It was the keeping track of characters, writing style, and racism.
You're right. You're so right. I like this one because I find it really creepy. Like, it is actually, like, the setup is in itself quite scary. You know, just the idea of, like, people, you know, anyone that's on their own in the house is liable to be dead. Just that, that idea I find quite, like, ooh, I don't know, I find it very enjoyable. And there's, like...
Especially... Sorry, go on.
I was going to say, and there's, like, no help coming. I think it's that as well. Because in other books, like Murder on the Orient Express or, you know, a lot of her books, it's about, like, Poirot or Marple solving a case. And they are, you know, they're the mommy and daddy. You know, they're there to kind of, like, keep everything under control. Whereas in this one, like, no one is there to help. No one knows this is happening. No one, like, help is not coming.
Yeah.
And yeah, it is just like a very wild, scary little thought.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like because the island is very isolated, it's very dark, the power cuts out, the weather's bad. Like, it does kind of have all of those ingredients for being really creepy. But the bit that really got me, I generally didn't find it that creepy though, because it's so, they're all so kind of polite. No one really freaks out. They spend a lot of the book kind of saying, well, anyway, we'll have dinner. Like, it, do you know what I mean? But the scene when Mr. Justice Wargrave is found dead is horrendous.
Yes.
There's been a power cut. Someone has gone upstairs and screamed because she's walked into some seaweed that has been left hanging in her room. So she thought it was like a hand, and she cries out. All the men run upstairs to see what the noise was, and they leave someone behind. They come back downstairs and find him. Mr. Justice Wargrave was sitting in his high back chair at the end of the room, two candles burnt on either side of him. But what shocked and startled the onlookers was the fact that he sat there robed in scarlet with a judge's wig upon his head. That image is terrifying.
Yes. Yeah.
I hate that.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, hated that. Made me feel sick. But in a good way. I thought it was really good.
Yeah, I just really like it. I just find it, like, creepy and fun and, like, yeah, just kind of, I don't know, I sort of quite like the ending as well, like, the framing of it, of, you know, it sort of ends as this, like, unsolved mystery, and then you do get the resolution because the architect of the whole plot and the killer cannot resist the urge to, like, write it all down in a note and put it in a bottle and send it out to sea, which later gets found. So that you as the reader do kind of get the satisfaction of the resolution, even though it sort of looks a bit like you won't.
Yeah. Because it ends, basically, but when it ends, you have a conversation, you have an epilogue between, like, someone at Scotland Yard, like a police officer and an inspector. And they're basically saying, yes, but this person had definitely died. No, but this person, the chair had been kicked out. No, but the chair was moved. So every death that could perceivably be suicide, there's a reason to explain why that's not possible. So it seems like you're not going to be able to, there's no way to know what order they died or that who could possibly have been the culprit. And I loved that because I was reading that and I was like, I'm so confused. Like, I can't figure this out. Like, if that's not how she died, then, and she was the last one living, then I don't understand. But then when you're reading the final epilogue, the note in the bottle, it's still really smart because there are these lots of little clues. So you still get the satisfaction of figuring out who the author of the letter is and why they had constructed this situation to, like, bump off all these people. Like, they were all chosen for a reason. In a very, like, Dexter-esque, like, she created Dexter. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're so right. Yeah, because I think it also, I don't know, I feel like through reading a lot of Agatha Christie books and then, you know, thrillers, I think it does give you, like, the investigative tools to read and interpret other thrillers. Because I think once you've read, you know, for example, like, two, you know, the two books that we're talking about today, and then There Were None and Murder on the Orient Express, you sort of get this understanding that for a thriller to work, the killer has to be someone that is in the book. So if you have got to, like, 80% of the way through the book and nobody else has emerged as, like, a sort of potential suspect, it must be someone that you've already encountered, which in a book like this, where people are getting bumped off one by one, is a very, you know, interesting concept to think about, because you know that they are there. And if it's an island, they can't, you know, be turning up in the last 20 pages, and that also wouldn't be satisfying as a reader.
On the other hand, though, I don't find it wildly satisfying. This is less so true with And Then There Were None compared to Murder on Orient Express, but I understand it's kind of a trope that she has, is that often the perpetrator is often, it's not their real identity and it's not who they say they are. So there is something a little bit dissatisfying about, like, oh, okay, well, there's no way I could have known that. Like, it's in true twist territory rather than like plot development territory, which has the potential to be a little bit tiresome, but, you know.
That's also us reading it in the 21st century.
Yeah, she sold 2 billion books, so fine. You know, clearly.
No, and I also do think that, like, all of this suffers from it becoming, like, a massive genre that has loads of, you know, things to kind of, that have been doing the same thing for the last, like, you know, 80 years. Whereas, you know, at one time this would have been highly original.
Yeah, well, exactly. And surprising. I think when you consider the fact that this was potentially the first, like, locked room murder mystery, that's pretty mind-blowing.
Agree.
Although I suppose, yeah, of that, like, whodunit ilk, because obviously locked room murder mysteries have existed forever. Sherlock Holmes, I'm sure Edgar Allan Poe had one as well, but can I read you the two bits that made me laugh?
Yes.
So there are two moments in this book, because it's also, despite the fact that it's a murder mystery and it's very dark, it's also got some wit in it. She's very funny. I think Poirot also is just hilarious. But yeah, two bits in and then the one that made me laugh. First of all, when the first man, the first murder occurs, when this dude takes a sip of his drink and he basically just drops down stone cold dead. And there is a doctor among them, and he runs over to kind of inspect him and see what's happened. He picks up the glass, and it says here, he was sniffing now at the glass. He dipped a finger into the dregs and very cautiously just touched the finger with the tip of his tongue. And then they conclude that it was fucking cyanide.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah. Sir, the man took one sip and dropped down stone cold dead, and you're licking your little thingy that's just been in there. No, like, you don't need to do that. He clearly died because of the contents of the glass. Just, yeah. That's fine. He's not going to have, like, an allergy to brandy that developed in the last 10 minutes. Like, okay, so that tickled me. And then also, just this little line later on. So this is, like, page 163, so it's about halfway through. We've got three people down, so there's seven people left. And they've just realised that, so they were all invited to the island by a Mr. U.N. Owen, which they have just realised is Mr. No One.
Unknown.
That makes sense? Unknown, sorry. Oh my God, yeah. So they've just figured out that it's an unknown person. So they've realised that this Mr. U.N. Owen, Mr. Unknown, is probably among them. And this dude gives a speech, which is like, so, my dear young lady, this is no time for refusing to look facts in the face. We are all in grave danger. One of us is UN Owen, and we do not know which of us. Of the 10 people who came to this island, 3 are definitely cleared. Anthony Marston, Mrs. Rogers, and General MacArthur have all gone beyond suspicion, because they're dead. There are 7 of us left. Of those 7, 1 is, if I may so express myself, a bogus little soldier boy, which I really enjoy.
You know who I can imagine calling someone a bogus little soldier boy?
Who?
Jenny Tighe. I can just hear it in her voice.
I just really enjoyed it. I was like, it's such a kind of a serious moment. He's really feeling himself, and he's really, you know, getting everyone all riled up. And then he comes out with that.
What a line. Like,
sir.
Oh, sir.
And yeah, I definitely found that it really did pick up. Like, once I was into the swing of it, because, I mean, that's page 163 and there's only 3 people dead.
Mm.
So in the following 100 pages, 7 more people die. Like, it gets really spicy. And I was, you know, I was more into it then.
And I do think that, you know, the resolution is quite sort of interesting, that it's someone who's decided to, like, take it upon themselves to bump off people that got away with murder. Like, that's quite a, like, you know, if
Barry
we're talking
Dexter.
About, like, psychological motivations, like, that's quite a good one.
Yeah, no, I agree. It didn't occur to me that it would be something quite so elegant, which is a ridiculous thing to admit, really, because it's one of the best-selling books of all time. Like, of course it's going to have something, you know, special about it.
Yeah.
And yeah, I did really like that. And I did really like, as you learn, so each of the islanders, apart from the Honourable Justice Wargrave, who is the perpetrator, all nine of the others are all responsible, either directly or indirectly, for someone's murder. But each death was, each, the circumstances around each death was somehow outside of the law.
Yes.
So, for example, one man was a general during the war and he sent his wife's lover to certain death. So that's not something that you can be imprisoned for. So as a judge, this was something that he found very difficult, which is also why some of the characters are so vile. And I absolutely loved this line from Anthony Marston. I actually underlined it and just wrote, oh, right. He says in a slow, puzzled voice, I've just been thinking, John and Lucy Coombs must have been a couple of kids I ran over near Cambridge. Beastly bad luck. And the judge says acidly, for them or for you? And he's like, well, I was thinking for me, but of course you're right, sir. It was damn bad luck on them too. It's like, Jesus wept, sir. Like, you don't even seem to give a shit.
There's a reason he's the first to die.
Yeah, like, some of the people do experience remorse for their actions, but he doesn't. He doesn't give a hoot.
He does not. So yes, I do like that one. I do think it's fun to read. I think it's sort of creepy. I find it quite satisfying. And I think it is quite elegantly done with the main story, the kind of Scotland Yard investigation, and then the epilogue. And I think that is quite a sort of neat little package of a book. Whereas Murder on the Orient Express is much more sort of straightforward in that it is Hercule Poirot, it is one story, one kind of moment, there is no kind of packaging of it, and it is, you know, possibly her most famous book. Would you like to give us a little...
Yes.
What would you like to say?
I'll nutshell it, but I presume everyone can guess from the title what it's about.
Yes.
It's about a murder that occurs on the train from Istanbul to... Where does it end? Paris?
I think it goes all the way to London.
Okay, London, yeah. It's about a murder that occurs whilst the train is caught in a snowfall. So no one can get on or off the train. The carriages, the space between each carriages is locked, so you can't really roam between carriages. And there's only a limited... The train is full, but there's only a limited number of people who could possibly have committed the crime. A man is found dead in his little carriage chamber, what they called, in his room.
Yes.
And he happened to have asked, when he realised that he was a kind of neighbour to Poirot, the detective... He asked if he would protect him because he was convinced that someone was trying to kill him, that his life was in danger. But Poirot basically says, I don't like your face, I don't trust you, and I'm not interested in trying to protect you.
Yes.
Which is quite a shocking thing to say, but, you know, it's his right to choose with whom he works. And Mr. Ratchet was correct to be concerned because he is found stone cold dead.
He is certainly found dead. He is the victim of the murder on the Orient Express. So you haven't read all of this, but you know the whole story. Is that correct?
Yes. So I have been reading really slowly. I'm only 100 pages into it, but I have I've gone and just spoiled it for myself, so I know the full plot. But I will continue reading it to the end because I'm really enjoying it. I'm immediately liking it much more than And Then There Were None.
Interesting.
Although... Having said that, I feel like the actual setup, the twists and the reveals of And Then There Were None, I think I'm going to like more than Murder on the Orient Express.
Yes. I can see that based on what I know about you and your feeling. You know, what you want from a thriller or a mystery or whatever.
Me and my horrible little brain and the things that please me.
So, yeah, I like this one. I don't love... So, okay, here is a thing. I read this with my eyeballs and I liked it, but I listened to another Poirot story, which is The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, on Audible, and I found Poirot so annoying and like smug and unbearable that I was like, I don't want to read another one about this little bitch ever again as long as I live. But maybe it was just the narrator, maybe it was just that book, maybe he was just being rude in that book, and maybe, I don't know, whereas I just found him so, like, smug and was always sort of asking these, like, rhetorical questions to which you knew that he knew the answer. Whereas I think in this one, it for more of the book, he actually doesn't know what's going on. So maybe that's why he's less annoying. Because it is, you know, it's a good little mystery. And one of the key things about this story is that there are, like, I don't know, 12... There's 12 people. 12 people in the compartment. And they all... They're pretty much all completely separate. There's, like, a married couple. And there's, like, the man who was murdered was travelling with, like, two members of staff. But apart from that, they're all kind of single people, like, quite disparate. From all across the world. All walks of life. And none of them know each other. None of them really have reason to, like, lie for each other. But they all manage to provide these alibis for each other. Which basically means that it's, like, completely impossible to figure out what happened and who done it. Because it can't really have been anyone. So that's quite a, like, interesting little setup for the... It's not just about kind of someone being murdered in what is essentially a locked room. It's the fact that, like, no one is implicating anyone because everyone has an alibi.
And, like, there's loads of clues and they don't all necessarily make sense. Like, yes. There's a pipe cleaner found by the body and a handkerchief that's marked with an initial that no one on the train seems to have.
They do have the initial, but it's, like, a kind of handkerchief that none of them would own because it's, like, too fancy. And, you know, it would be, like, a sort of... A school teacher would not have a handkerchief like that. And
blah, yeah, blah, blah. And, like, the super rich princess doesn't have that initial and, like...
Yes. So, yeah, there's just lots of kind of intriguing little details that are making it completely impossible for our friend Hercule Poirot to figure out what is happening. And, yeah, I think this is a great little mystery. And yeah, I like it. I don't know if I'd actually read it before. I think I may have only seen various films, but I was really happy to read it. And it's a fun little tale, in my opinion.
So I definitely am really enjoying it, particularly reading it this time of year, because it's very cozy. Like, the snow outside is falling. Like, I find it very atmospheric. Same with And Then There Were None. Like, the setup is fucking great. And also, like, the claustrophobia of being on a train is also great. I really like that. What would you say, how many Christie's have you read, and what ones would you recommend for a little gal like me who... I found things that I like in both of these books and there are things that I dislike in both these books.
Yes, so I have read And Then There Were None, Towards Zero, which is good. I like that. I like them all, but I read Towards Zero quite recently. Ordeal by Innocence, Murder of Roger Ackroyd, Murder in the Orient Express, Death on the Nile, Evil Under the Sun. Maybe that's all. I've never read a Miss Marple, actually, so I should probably read one of those before I make too many pronouncements on...
Next on your list.
Yeah. So yeah, I've read a few. I haven't read, like, loads and loads, but I do like her. And I've got one called The Crooked House and The Hollow, which I bought in a charity shop recently, because I did an event this summer, which is possibly what has ignited my renewed interest in Agatha Christie. I did an event this summer for HarperCollins in conjunction with Agatha Christie Limited, which was because HarperCollins published one of her short story collections, which was a sort of summer murder collection of all these short stories that happen, you know, either on holiday or, like, in the heat of summer. And I interviewed Sophie Hannah and Alex Michaelides. Sophie Hannah now writes the Poirot novels, and Alex Michaelides writes thrillers. And yeah, they were both just so, like, passionate and knowledgeable about Agatha Christie. And there were a couple that they talked about in such glowing terms that I was like, I really want to read those. And one of those was Towards Zero. So I read that, and then I bought The Hollow. And I will read that in the fullness of time. So yeah, that's my background with Agatha Christie. And I have also been to The Mousetrap.
So okay, maybe I will read another one. I feel like, okay, one of the reasons why I feel like it's worth reading Agatha Christie is because even if, like me, you don't necessarily turn towards the kind of cozier
side of crime. I say cozy because these wouldn't have been cozy to her contemporary readers. Like, they would have been, I presume they would have been a bit more kind of edgy. But, you know, it's the legacy. And, like, just thinking about how many books and how many authors clearly inspired by, and then there were none. Like, Ruth Ware has a book out called One by One, which is obviously an homage to And Then There Were None.
Lucy Foley's career would be nowhere without Christie.
And, like, yeah. I don't know about you, but I loved The Hunting Party.
Yeah.
It's such a very cozy, satisfying, like, just whodunit. And I really like the guest list as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's just, it's really valuable to, like, read the source material, to, like, read where it all kind of kicked off from. So I'm glad that I read them, even though I definitely would have given up on And Then There Were None. And it did take me quite a long time to get through it, considering it's quite a small paperback. But that is also in part just because I feel like my brain has turned to a melted milkshake over this quite arduous year. And my reading pace has slowed down so fucking much.
Yeah.
Like,
and we're in December, yeah. You know, we've all given up on life.
We're all winding down. And on that note, let's wind down.
Indeed.
I have nothing more to say on this subject, apart from to thank you for finally forcing me to read my first two Agatha Christies.
I am glad that you... Well, you only read one in full. Let's be real.
Oh, yeah, I didn't even read two. Not yet.
So how do you feel... Before we go, before we part ways, yeah. How do you feel about the conclusion of Murder on the Orient Express? Less satisfying than And Then There Were None?
So, definitely slightly less satisfying because... It is more in line with what I understood to be Agatha Christie's style. So everyone actually knows the person who is central to the murder. We won't bother explaining it. If you read it, you know. If you haven't read it, you won't know. But yeah, like, so everyone, it turns out, no one is who they said they were. No one is from the place they claimed they were from. No one is living the life that they claim they were living. They're all in on it. They all murdered him. And it's all because of sad reasons connected to a horrible thing that he was responsible for. That's more in keeping with what I expect from Agatha Christie. So I was a little bit less surprised by that. But then, you know, I feel like maybe it would have been more gripping if I'd been learning that, like, in the grips of the actual story. Whereas I feel like the thing with the judge, you know, that whole vibe in And Then There Were None, genuinely really surprised me, really liked it. Had no idea that's what was going to happen. Yeah, and I was really into it. Especially because the judge has the most memorable death. Yes. So he was basically the primary character that was, like, in my line of sight. Yeah, I found that really satisfying.
Well, I'm glad. Well, it has been a pleasure doing business with you, my friend. You know, it feels like it's been a while. We did sort of a few interviews back to back, so we haven't recorded a standard little chat episode for a while.
Yeah, and it's been nice to get back on the old horse.
Yeah. So what have we got now? We've got...
In the future.
Yes. Describe the rest of the year.
We're going to do our end of year tag. We're just going to answer some questions about our year in reading and what we're looking to do in December and all of that jazz. And then we're going to do our books of the year. As usual, as with the last couple of years, we're not going to do, like, our most anticipated books of 2022, just because we find if the ones we're most excited for are not necessarily the ones that we end up loving the most. And then we just feel like everyone wants to know what we thought of them. And it's like, don't really want to talk about it now. Yeah. Change my mind. Yeah. Yeah. So we're not going to do that. So you'll just have to wait for our books of the year.
If they're good, they'll be good. And then we'll talk about them next year.
Exactly. All right. That's it.
I will see you on the flip side, my good bitch.
See you anon.
Bye.
Bye.